wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Dear Science for this week. I'm joined by, we're joined in studio here today with by expert Dr. Daniel Thomas. Hello, how are you going this morning?
Yeah, great. Great to be back.
Yeah, right on. We've got a couple, we've got three very interesting topics for us to talk about today. History, prehistory, and the search for Atlantis. Did you want to start with your first topic? You've shared this piece about deciphering ancient Roman texts.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that means?
Yeah, let's start a few thousand years ago with the Roman Empire. So Solway team, which is, I've learned is...
Oh, your mic's... Is that mine? Okay.
So Latin was the original language of the Romans, and it remained the language of imperial administration, legislation, and the military throughout the classical period. So we're talking 2,800 years ago to around 1,500 years ago. And just like we have writing everywhere around us in the language that we speak, inscriptions in Latin were commonplace across the Roman world. And so these were things like laying out decrees of emperor to graffiti in the streets. And so these inscriptions are so common that around 1,500 of them are discovered every year. And in the words of the lead author of the study this week, these inscriptions are so precious to historians because they offer firsthand evidence of ancient thought, language, society, and history. What makes them unique is that they are written by the ancient people themselves across all social classes on any subject. It's not just history written by the elite. So that's from Yanis Asayal, a researcher of Google's AI lab, DeepMind.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, with these inscriptions, when they're found, they're often damaged or incomplete. And so the researchers often don't know where or when they were inscribed and or what the entire message was. And so it can be actually difficult to work out what these 1,500 new inscriptions every year are.
Yeah, it's kind of, it'd probably be hard to see how relevant that might be, like even in the time that it was made.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So yeah, that context is key. And so if we think about this, it's a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle piece. It's hard to figure out the entire image from just one piece, but we use information from any one piece to figure out what it's connected to.
Mm-hmm.
And so another way to really think about this is, imagine you're driving south from Auckland and you see a road sign for a city coming up, but it's damaged. And all you can see is the phrase Emelt. Now, we can figure out from context that that probably refers to Hamilton, but that's because we've got that contextual information. And if you take that away, then it can be really challenging to figure out what that was actually trying to say. So that's kind of the scene that's being set here. So the researchers generated a generative neural network, which is an AI tool that can be trained to identify complex relationships between types of data. And so they used dates and locations and meanings of Latin transcriptions, and they fed this generative model 170,000 of these transcriptions from museums and libraries across the world. And so this new paper is reporting on the fact that now researchers have this tool where you can provide it with an incomplete inscription, just a piece of a slab with some Latin on it, that's got some information about it. And what it will do now is return to you the likely date when it was made, to decade, probably the province in which it was made, one of 62 across the Roman Empire, and other information. It might even complete the inscription for you.
And what's the accuracy of this kind of method of looking at the old inscriptions that you've found, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was handed over to 20 historians to actually try this out. And they gave it some inscriptions where they kind of knew the information but held a lot of that back from the model. to test it out, and they found that actually it was giving them the right answer 90% of the time.
Oh, wow. That's really good.
What about the other 10%?
Well, exactly. And so is that error rate good enough? And that kind of comes into the total point of building this model, of putting it all together. And in order to do this without the model, what researchers need to do is themselves visit museums where these inscriptions are scattered and really put in the legwork to figure it out. So even that 90% starting point, if you like, really does help out with the research that these historians are doing. So that's really why this has been generated as a tool to help Latin scholars really step up and improve their efficiency of working through these inscriptions.
That's very exciting. I wanted to chuck on to our next topic. I was having a read of this paper that you'd sent. I have never heard of the term finger fluting. Faith, do you know this one?
No, I haven't.
It's when you put your fingers like on the wall as you're walking past.
Ah, okay.
And it leaves a little mark. I don't know. Well, not always, I imagine. But I've never heard of this term before, but I'm sure everyone, like, you've done it before. Did you want to talk about what this paper was discussing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the finger flutings, the grooves that are made by dragging your fingers across a surface, 100%. So we're going to jump in time now from a couple of thousand years ago all the way back to around 8,500 years ago. And we're going to recenter ourselves on Australia this time. And so the history of the First Nations people in Australia stretches back tens of thousands of years, and there's archaeological research on material objects that has given a good record of this time. But this paper, this new study, is about some physical evidence of a cultural practice, and so that's why this one is really special. So this story captures this physical evidence of this cultural practice for the Gunai Kurnai people in Southeast Australia, and it deals with a limestone cave that has these really soft walls. So over time, water has been percolating through into this limestone cave, and bacteria have been living on this softened wall, and that combination has actually covered the wall in these glittering microcrystals, and it's really softened these walls to the extent that the researchers in this study described as having the texture of Play-Doh. And so what they're reporting on is that this Play-Doh glittering surface is covered in these finger flutings, in these these markings. And these markings are on these walls that are away from natural light. So you've got to really descend into this cave. You have to take artificial light with you, so you've got to be well prepared. So torches. And once you're there, under this torchlight, these microcrystalline Play-Doh-like walls, they glitter. These are the glittering caves. And so the Gunai Kurnai people describe this particular cave as Warrabrook. That's the name of it. Now, what's really special here is these glittering walls, and just on the places where there are these glittering walls, they're covered in these finger flutings, these marks that are made by dragging fingers across these walls. And it's not just about putting your hand out to balance against the walls. These are intentional marks. Across the many hundreds of these markings found on these walls, there are two hands side by side dragging together. There are tiny finger marks, so the marks of children, but they're on the surface of this, on the ceiling of this cave. So they were being lifted up by adults to reach the surface. So really intentional.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, and the markings are only in the places with the glittering caves.
So that's showing that they were trying to, like, show that they were there, I guess. Is that what you're saying?
Well, so definitely there's this connection between the glittering and the finger fluting. And so the filaments from the artificial light, so the carbon fiber, or the carbon fragments that had dropped off, have been carbon dated. That gives us this 8,500-year mark. But what's really cool here is it connects back to oral tradition, to a cultural practice that's retained as part of the oral history of the Gunai Kurnai people. And they are saying, they refer to these caves as actually only being places where certain people go. So very special individuals. They were known as the people who would use particular practices for healing or cursing. but they were always associated with the crystals and these powdered minerals as part of their practice. Mm-hmm. So here is physical evidence recorded in this cave of people from perhaps 420 generations ago heading in here to leave behind this mark on these caves.
Very interesting. That's a very human-based story, I feel like.
Yeah, it's cool that they lasted that long.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The final story you've got for us is talking about crossings out of Africa. It seems like the difference in over time with like tidal like height has impacted how you can trace where people have been crossing. Sorry, how about you explain? I feel like I'm...
100%. No, that's exactly right. So we're going to jump again in time. And so for this last story, we're going to head back to between 20 and 30,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so around 20,000 years ago, that was the last glacial maximum. That's when we had a whole lot of water stored on land as ice, and that lowered sea level, lowered it by 125 meters. So to give you some idea of that, Te Kapa Moana, so Hauraki Gulf, completely drained. You could walk straight line from Auckland to Coromandel. The North and South Islands, they're connected between Taranaki and Nelson. There's no Fovo Strait. So that gives you some idea of the extent of this. Now, there are no people in Aotearoa at that time, but elsewhere around the world there were, and there were crossings. Now, people had crossed out of Africa by 20,000 years ago, but people were still moving around. And this study has produced a new map of these coastlines around, especially the Middle East and Northern Africa during these times. And they've taken into account this effect of storing all this water on land to see what that then does to the exposed land area. And what they have found is that there is a place within the Red Sea. So the Red Sea, if you're unfamiliar, is that little piece of water that runs up near Northern Africa between the Arabian Peninsula. The Suez Canal connects it across to the Mediterranean. So that had drained in many places, including this particular region called Fowl Bay. So that was exposed to air. But the researchers also observed that today there are coral patches, unusual coral patches that are growing, especially in Fowl Bay. And they argue that this coral needs to grow on hard substrates. And while they are at great pains to point out that they've got no archaeological evidence here, they do suggest that maybe this coral is growing on submerged stone buildings from an ancient civilization, exactly, that was there when it was exposed and has since been flooded and is now covered in coral.
Now clicks for me what you meant by search for Atlantis.
Exactly, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. It said that there's new questions about human settlements. Is that kind of what you're talking about? You think that there's things under the water, I suppose, that we haven't found?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're arguing. So they're saying that during the time when sea level, when the tide was really far out, people were living much closer to where the shoreline was, and over time that's now flooded. And so these, what might have been ancient settlements, have now been submerged, and so we need to go and look for them.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, I guess that's everything. Is there anything else you wanted to add on to that one?
Well, I'll give you a quote from that paper. So this is the lead researcher, who is Jerome Dobson from the University of Kansas, quoting the paper, "We searched for and found no archaeological record of submerged stone structures. However, we discovered that patch corals are extraordinarily abundant in Fowl Bay, noted that corals require a solid substrate, and now recommend systematic exploration to determine whether its substrates are natural or constructed."
Is that Fowl Bay as in, that's foul, F-O-U-L?
It is F-O-U-L.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
But yeah, I don't know the origin of the name.
Oh, hopefully it's not a very foul place. I hope it's nicer than the name suggests.
Great. That's a great place to end on. Thank you so much for your time today, Daniel. Thank you to MOTAT and thank you to Science. That's the end of Dear Science for today.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.